Fort Lauderdale's water woes, lost money for HIV, trauma from Hurricane Dorian, and a tour of one of South Florida's most diverse ecosystems. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The sewage and water pipe system in Fort Lauderdale is old and in desperate need of replacing. And it was made painfully apparent this summer when a water main broke and thousands went without water for days. Also, a new Guardian investigation found that under Governor Rick Scott, tens of millions of dollars in AIDS and HIV treatment were left on the table.
In my years as governor, one thing you try to do is try to make sure everybody gets taken care of.
And we'll get an update on the recovery of the Abaco Islands from the BBC. Finally, have you heard of Pelican Island? The tiny island is one of the rarest places on Earth, here in our own backyard. We'll learn why it launched the National Wildlife Refuge System. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, it's already known that Fort Lauderdale's water system, which includes sewage and pipes, is old, and it could collapse at any moment. Just a few months ago, thousands of Broward County residents had their tap water threatened because of a damaged water main near the Fort Lauderdale Executive Airport. As storms like Hurricane Dorian threatened to cause devastation in South Florida, some are questioning whether the water system could handle a natural disaster of that magnitude. A public hearing for Fort Lauderdale's budget is scheduled for today, where city leaders will determine how millions of dollars should be spent on fixing the sewage and water main systems. We're joined now by the Sun Sentinel's Larry Barshewski. Larry, thank you so much for the time.
Hi, Lewis.
What do city officials think of the water system as they know it right now in Fort Lauderdale? They understand how bad it is.
Yes, I think that's true. I think the city commission and the officials all realize that they're dealing with a system that needs major repairs and major renovations, and they've got to start work on it quickly.
So help us understand the extent of the damage right now. I mean, not the damage so much, but how old it is and how weak that system really is.
Many of the pipes in the system are more than 50 years old. The main water treatment plant, the Five Ash Water Treatment Plant, was built in the 1950s itself. There's just an awful lot of things that need to be replaced and rebuilt.
Has anyone ever given a good explanation as to how we got to this point, why we're at this level where we haven't fixed or replaced a lot of these systems before?
Well, you know, Fort Lauderdale's not alone. A lot of cities, a lot of older cities are facing similar issues, but the problems seem to have become acute in Fort Lauderdale. I think a lot of it can go back to the recession, like in 2008 and 2009. The city had been doing things to repair its system. It actually had a big plan in the late 2000s, up to 2011, of bringing all the septic tank systems onto the city's sewer lines. It also did a major rehabilitation of a second water treatment plant, a smaller water treatment plant that's in the city. But after the recession, there were budget cuts, and the city was looking for ways to cut corners and not raise the tax rate. They also turned to the water and sewer system to pull out millions of dollars that were in that system to pay for the city's other operating expenses so that they didn't have to raise taxes. In the end, the system's just been neglected.
So, you know, the main water plant system, you talked about Five Ash, there's been talk about either fixing it or just straight out rebuilding it, build a whole new system. What are the problems with that plant?
You name it, it's old. I mean, okay. I'm not a scientist, so I can't go into all the details, but I mean, that treatment plant is responsible for, you know, it sanitizes the water, it softens the water, it makes it look pretty so you don't mind drinking it. You know, all those aspects of what drinking water should be is done at the plant. And right now, the plant could go at any time. A report a couple of years ago said there could be a calamitous problem at the plant that would just stop it from working. So the city is now at a point, like you said, repair, replace. They're going to be making that decision in the very near future. The city manager has said recently that the report that the city's going to be getting is going to pretty much say that the cost to repair is going to be just as expensive as the cost to replace. So that it may be the city looks to replace the plant. The problem is, too, the city's got to keep that, even if they build a new plant, the city's got to keep that plant, the five ash plant, working while it builds a new plant. And right now, they're looking for $32 million in repairs on the plant right now that they're asking for bids on for work to do at the plant. So it's not like they can leave five ash alone under any circumstance. They still have to keep it functioning until a new plant gets built.
I'm talking with Larry Barshefsky. He's a reporter for the Sun Sentinel. We're discussing, again, the issues facing Fort Lauderdale's water systems and how that's going to impact tens of thousands of people in the county. There's a final public hearing again tonight on the city's budget for next year. And if you live, by the way, in Fort Lauderdale, you know, is the water system something that concerns you? Find us on social media, Facebook or Twitter, at WLRN Sundial. We'd like to hear your thoughts on this. So, Larry, you know, what is the goal then right now? Because it's talking about, we're talking about sewage system. We're talking about the water pipes. We keep hearing stories of, obviously, the sewage system collapsing. And, you know, then, of course, a lot of wastewater ends up in the streets. How are they tackling these two problems?
Well, what the city is finding, the city can't address one and then do the other layer. They've got to work on both of them at the same time. The emphasis the last year or two has been the city's sewer system, because the state came in and said, hey, your system is in bad shape. And there was, over the last 3 years, they've had more than 20 million gallons of raw sewage spill out onto streets and into bodies of water because of broken pipes or pipes breaking. So they were fixated on starting to move forward on the sewage problem. And then this five ash problem occurred in July and just other lines breaking, and realizing that, you know, it doesn't have a lot, the city doesn't have a lot of time to deal with the water side as well. So they've got to address both at once. And they're, I think a report a couple of years ago estimated for the water and wastewater system, they're looking at like maybe $1.4 billion in work needed over the next 20 years. And they probably could all use it tomorrow, but you just physically can't spend that much money. So it's like $1.4 billion, but give it a 20-year time frame to start doing it and hope everything holds up while you're making the repairs.
And we found out really how weak the system is back this summer. As you pointed out, there was a water pipe break. There was work that's being done. They accidentally hit one of the pipes. And a lot of people were without water for a little while. So what did we learn from that?
Well, they learned just how critical that five ash water treatment plant was. What happened, the water break that they had, the pipe that broke was the pipe feeding five ash. So without the water coming into five ash, there was no water to treat so that people could drink. On the other side, you know, if the pipe breaks, well, there's a neighborhood or maybe a part of the city that ends up going without water. This affected the ability, without five ash functioning, this affected the ability to get water to the whole city and a number of other cities that also rely on the city's water supply, like Wilton Manors and parts of Oakland Park and some other cities.
And one of the other things, too, that came from this, it was amazing, was the fact that the city had a hard time, workers had a hard time finding the valves to move water around. They don't even know where all the valves are.
Yes, and that's a big problem. I mean, you're talking about an old system, 50 years, some pipes 50 years and older. And so there were records kept about things, but how precise were those records? And so when they initially started digging to what they wanted to do at Five Ash, when the pipe broke, they wanted to reroute the water around that pipe so that the water could continue getting into Five Ash so that it could be treated and sent to the public for drinking. But they had trouble finding the valve, so they got down, and then, well, it's supposed to be in this location, but it wasn't quite there, so they had to keep going until they found the valves. And then when they found the valves, it was like, oh, these valves don't work. They hadn't been maintained properly, and there's procedures that you can use for maintaining valves. And so that was the double whammy that the city faced.
So the valves don't work. We don't even know where they are, a lot of them. Let me finish with this. We got lucky in South Florida. Dorian didn't hit us directly like we thought it would. City leaders have to be really thankful, because that kind of damage, and if it had done anything to Five Ash, that could have been disastrous.
Yes, and the city manager, Chris Lagerblum, mentioned this in a discussion he recently had with the city's infrastructure task force committee, that sort of overseeing a public body to oversee what the city is doing with its water and wastewater pipes and problems. And he said basically something like that would have, it's almost certain, would have just made Five Ash inoperable. That it would have just, and that there is really no alternative. The Five Ash treats about 40 million gallons a day of water for the public. The other Peel plant does about 12 million gallons a day. The city has some agreements with other water providers, so if they have a problem, they can get some water, but they can't reach that 40 million gallons a day. So
right.
Basically, it would take, I don't know if we're talking months or longer, the city would be on bottled water because the public would not have water coming out of its faucets if that damage were to happen to Five Ash.
Larry Barshefsky, again, reporter for the Sun Sentinel, and you could read up on his stories on the coverage, again, of these the troubled water systems, you know, in Fort Lauderdale and what city leaders are doing about it. Follow us on Sundial at WLRN Sundial on Facebook or Twitter. Larry, thank you so much for the time.
Thanks, Lewis.
All right, still to come, we're going to look at an investigation that found that while Rick Scott was governor, he denied millions of funds to fight the HIV crisis. More coming up next.
No me quiero bajar del tren de la felicidad.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. South Florida has among the highest number of new HIV cases in the country. A new investigation by The Guardian shows that millions of dollars in federal funds for HIV prevention and treatment was turned away by the state while Rick Scott was governor. The investigation also found that state health officials, under the direction of Governor Scott, deliberately missed opportunities to secure federal funds to address the crisis. Ben Ryan is a freelance journalist and editor of PAWS magazine. That's a magazine that chronicles the lives of people living with HIV. And he's reported on this story for The Guardian. He joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Ben, thank you for the time. So how severe is the HIV crisis in Florida today relative to other big states like New York or Texas or California?
There are a lot of different ways to look at it, but let's just look at number of new diagnoses in the most recent year for which we have data, and that's 2017. Florida was the highest at about 4,800 new diagnoses of HIV, followed by California, 4,500, Texas, 4,350, New York, 2,800, and Georgia, 2,600. And if you also look at the per capita rate, so that's the number of new infections per 100,000 residents, Georgia's at the top at 30, followed by Florida at 27, and then Texas at 19, and New York 16 and California 14. So New York is a good comparison because the overall population of the state is about the same, and the HIV population itself is about 130,000, is about the same. But if you look, they've got about half of the diagnosis rate of Florida, and they've been spending very aggressively on their HIV epidemic, and there's a lot of coordination in the New York state between the government and activists and in different, you know, the medical system and so on. And that's something we're really not seeing in Florida, and Florida is paying the price in terms of new HIV infections and lack of proper treatment for people living with the virus.
What led you to this investigation? Was there something that just popped up that you found?
Yeah. Well, I started this in early 2016. I got a tip from an editor then that there were a pair of CDC grants that were rejected by the governor's office in 2015.
Governor Rick Scott at the time.
That's right. That's right. So I did all this work on it for about a month, and I interviewed all these people, and it was very much an open secret in the community, the HIV community in Florida, that this had happened. And these grants would have been about $16 million for HIV care, prevention, and treatment in Miami and Broward counties. But the one person who really knew the facts was a woman named Marlene LaLota, who at the time was the head of the HIV Bureau in the Florida Department of Health, and she wouldn't talk because she was still working for the Department of Health. And as I found throughout my investigation, it is pretty much impossible to get anyone who still works for the state in any capacity to talk to you. So what happened was I dropped the case because I couldn't prove it at the time, even though I knew what had happened. But 3 years later, earlier this year, I got word that Marlene had left the department and she was ready to talk. So I started talking to her. And while we're having this conversation about these $16 million grants, she said, oh, by the way, there was tens of millions of dollars we also ended up blocking. And I'm like, what did you just say? So turns out that there was about $54 million from HRSA for a program called Ryan White, which is a federal program that provides care and treatment for people living with HIV who are lower income. And ultimately, through a series of baffling bureaucratic maneuvers, the health department ultimately blocked $54 million in available funds to spend through that program between 2015 and 2017.
What was Governor Scott's reasoning or his administration's reasoning for refusing that money?
I would never prove that he definitely did all this on purpose, although I did hear from I did know that his office did deliberately block those CDC funds. However, what we can look at is the political backdrop during this period. We know that Governor Scott was very much against federal funds for lots of things. He rejected billions of dollars for light rail. He rejected scores of billions of dollars in Affordable Care Act grants when that was just getting started. And he was very opposed to the expansion of Medicaid, which, by the way, would really help people living with HIV and at risk for HIV in Florida. So all that was going on during this. So essentially what my colleague Noah Pransky, who's an investigative journalist in Florida, was able to figure out from his sources in the state legislature was that ultimately it looked as if that they were a political consistency was driving this from the part of the governor's office because they didn't want to accept some funds while rejecting others for health care in the state.
So the Miami Herald recently caught up with now Senator Rick Scott and asked him why the federal money wasn't spent.
First off, in my years as governor, one thing you try to do is try to make sure everybody gets taken care of. And whether it's HIV or cancer or all these things, you try to do everything you can to make sure that, you know, if there's federal resources that makes sense for your state, you use them. On top of that, if there's private resources, you do the same thing.
So there's no like particular reason behind why that funding was used?
No.
So have you heard from, you know, the Scott administration or Scott himself, Rick Scott himself, as to why, again, that money wasn't spent at the time? And considering what you just heard him say?
Mm-hmm. Notice that he did not deny it. So when I saw that clip on Twitter a few days ago, I felt very gratified that I effectively had proved that, yes, they were behind this, because otherwise he would have denied it. I did get a statement when I was closing the story from his office, and it said, "Your characterization is not accurate. Senator Scott supports efforts by the administration to make sure everyone is getting the care they need." By administration, he means the federal government. "As governor, Senator Scott invested record funding for HIV/AIDS prevention," which is a lie, by the way, that he said before. He was referring to CDC dollars that were spent around that time that I was looking at. And PolitiFact already proved that the funding he was talking about was all coming from the federal government except for a small pittance from the state. And the only reason why it was a quote-unquote record in Florida was because HIV diagnoses were going up. Therefore, they qualified for more money from CDC for prevention.
I'm talking with freelance journalist Benjamin Ryan, and he's also editor of PAWS magazine. And Ryan has written extensively about the HIV epidemic in the U.S. for The New York Times, The Guardian, The Atlantic, and more. His recent piece in The Guardian looks at millions of dollars in federal money to address the epidemic in Florida that was not accepted under Governor Rick Scott. You know, something I wanted to touch on with you real quickly is this. I think it's important that we do some defining of terms these days, because we used to say HIV/AIDS epidemic. Now it's just HIV epidemic. Why is that?
Well, it's important to stress the difference between HIV and AIDS. HIV is the virus that, if left untreated, can cause AIDS. But thanks to the new treatments that came along in 1996, HIV is readily treatable, and people can live a long and healthy life with a life expectancy that approaches normal. So AIDS is a collection of syndromes that can be fatal that are driven by the damaged immune system. HIV damages the immune system. So you treat the virus with antiretrovirals, and what we've learned with research over the past years is that if you successfully treat the virus, meaning you fully suppress the viral load to an undetectable level, you cannot transmit the virus. So treatment is prevention, is the way the saying goes. So when you spend money on treatment, you're getting a double benefit out of it. You're benefiting that person's health, and you're also possibly preventing transmission to other people. And there's another thing called PrEP, which is the pre-exposure prophylaxis HIV prevention pill, sold under the brand name Truvada. And if HIV negative people take that, who are at risk for HIV, it approaches 100% efficacy to prevent them from acquiring the virus. And a lot of the money that we're talking about from CDC would have been spent for PrEP, which is sorely underused in Florida.
You know, something interesting you talked about a second ago is that there were people who, it was hard to talk to them while Rick Scott was in office, and that they were working for him. But did any individuals working under his administration push back against this ideology?
So what happened is in 2014, a woman named Michelle Talent, who had been working in the governor's budget office, was sent down to work as the budget director essentially for the health department. And that's when the real trouble started. Several of the people who were working in the HIV Bureau at the time spoke with me. They're now working elsewhere, not outside of the state. And they said they pushed back severely against Michelle Talent, who was blockading their attempts to get permission from the state government to spend these new HIV funds. The problem was that in Florida, when you have a budget, when you have an increase in funds coming from the outside of the government, that's counted as a budget increase. So you have to get permission from the legislature to spend it. Now, funds were increasing for their pot of money from HRSA, as I referred to earlier, for Ryan White programming, but they couldn't spend those new funds because they didn't have permission. And in fact, it appears that Michelle Talent prevented them from ever even asking the state government for permission to spend these funds.
I'm wondering how that money could have been spent. I'm wondering, like, what certain groups could have gotten access to that money that could have been used in helping people.
It's a little unclear to me exactly how it could have been spent, but it would have to have been on HIV programming. That's the law. So it could have been spent on treatment, improving linkage to care, as it's called. So when people are diagnosed, making sure they get in care and stay in care. That's a huge aspect of the HIV fight that's very important. And also on pre-exposure prophylaxis, PrEP, the HIV prevention pill.
You know, Miami-Dade and Broward have among the highest rates of HIV in most of the counties in the country.
That's right.
You know, and you pointed this out just a moment ago that, they were actually wanted to apply for certain amounts of money, almost $16 million combined that they could have gotten access to. But again, what happened there, and why did they have to go through the state to get that money?
Well, it was the rule that you have to channel these applications to the CDC through the state, even though the county health departments are applying for them. What I discovered is there's a very strict top-down management structure in the health department that goes all the way from the governor through the Surgeon General, down through the state health department, and down into the counties. So people are really afraid to step out of line because they'll get fired. At least that's the way it was during the Scott administration, from what I was told. So a nonprofit organization, a guy named Stephen Fallon at Latino Salud, which is an AIDS service organization for Latinos in Miami, wrote the grant application for that county. And the state government was partnering with the Broward County Department of Health to write their application for these pair of CDC grants that would have got about $16 million combined. But on the very last day, June 1st, 2015, that these applications were due, Marlene Lelota, who was the head of the HIV Bureau at the time, got word from upstairs that the governor's office had told them to cancel the applications, that they could not apply because they didn't have the permission from the state government to spend new funds. That was their excuse.
That hierarchy that you just described, do you see that in any other state?
It's so different here in New York State where I live. The New York City Department of Health and the New York State Department of Health, they partner with each other, but they're very much autonomous, and that allows for a lot of incredible flexibility, and that's what you really need. You need flexibility, innovation, creativity, and you need to tailor it to the communities that you're in, and who better to know that than nonprofit organizations who are working on the ground as well as county health departments.
Have we seen anything different in, the current administration, Governor Ron DeSantis? Mm-hmm. Is he still running things the same way?
There does seem to be a lot more flexibility and relaxation from what I've heard. But what I do know in particular is that after my article came out, a journalist asked Governor DeSantis that day how he felt about my story. And what the new governor said, was that he was very enthusiastic about receiving new money from the federal government because there's this huge plan that's backed by President Trump. It was created by HHS, the health department of the federal government. And to spend a lot more money on HIV, and in particular targeting 48 counties plus D.C. and San Juan, Puerto Rico, who have very high HIV rates. And in particular, that means 7 counties in Florida. So DeSantis expressed great enthusiasm for this new money. He said he basically was just frustrated he couldn't get it sooner. So that was very encouraging for the future of the epidemic in Florida.
Very interesting and difference. Again, we're two Republicans, mm-hmm. very different in their approaches. Yeah. Again, talking with freelance journalist Benjamin Ryan. By the way, you can find a link to his story in The Guardian on our social media, Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Again, looking at all the millions of dollars that were left on the table under Governor Rick Scott for the HIV epidemic. What did we lose out on? Benjamin, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Well, still to come, we're going to hear from a BBC reporter who recently visited the Abaco Islands and is following up on the recovery efforts. That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The recovery in the Bahamas after Hurricane Dorian will be slow and painful. 51 bodies have been uncovered so far. Thousands on the island remain without adequate food, water, and shelter. BBC News North America correspondent Aleem Makbul recently returned from the Abaco Islands in the Bahamas, and he's been reporting on the trauma Bahamians have experienced because of Hurricane Dorian. He joins us now from the BBC studios in Washington, D.C. Aleem Makbul, thank you so much for the time.
Yeah, hi, Lewis. Thanks for having me.
You know, my understanding is you arrived at the Abaco Islands shortly after Dorian had passed over. How did you get there?
Yeah, we were on one of the first flights into a place called Treasure Key on the very day that the airstrip was cleared, actually, by locals. So we had been trying for a couple of days to try and get anybody to get us into the affected area, but of course there were still very strong winds. A lot of people were not flying until that day. And so we went in, and the scene we saw first from the sky and then on the ground was just extraordinary. I've covered, you know, earthquakes and hurricanes in the past, but this was something else. And in speaking to people and seeing how sort of haunted they were by what they went through was something I'll take away from this. A lot of your listeners will remember going through Irma a couple of years ago in Miami. And, you know, it was not Category 5 at that stage. It went through relatively quickly. But it was still terrifying to go through, even if you were in sort of solid buildings. Here, because the hurricane went through with such force, such power, and went through so slowly, you know, this is something that people there were terrorized by for 2 days. You know, a lot of people talking about being in a bathtub for 2 days with a mattress covering them, or being in a closet for a couple of days. You know, some people I met, you know, their children had stopped speaking since the hurricane because they've been so terrified. So we got in earlier, and in some cases, you know, we were the first to ask people what they'd gone through, and some people just couldn't say they were that terrified, but you could see it in their faces.
What was it like for you getting around? And again, all I have are pictures or videos that I've seen. So, but you know, I remember living through Andrew and seeing what a Hurricane 5, Category 5, could do. Mm. But, you know, it seemed like there was nothing left. Everything got leveled. And I'm just wondering, how were you even able to get around?
You know, even in those kind of circumstances, you go for the goodwill of people there who wanted to get out the story of what had happened to them. And so people were very generous, even in a circumstance like that. Fuel was very low, but there were those willing to get us around, to help us get around, to be able to say to the outside world, you know, these people really are in need of everything, really. And as you say, there were some areas, of course, you know, in some cases, the people affected there were rich people with huge villas who had still gone through an awful experience. But on the other hand, you did have those areas which had been completely leveled. But these were often the poorest people who were the worst affected, particularly in a place called Marsh Harbour in Abaco. And there, the most shocking sight was a shanty town which had housed many hundreds of people. There wasn't a solid structure in the entire place. It was very close to the port. And seeing that for the first time was truly shocking. I mean, there were shipping containers that had been full of goods that had been slammed into this community, that had rolled over whatever structures there had been, and obviously had killed a lot of people. And when we got out of the car for the first time in that area, it wasn't just the sight. It was the smell of the place as well. You know, we're still talking about 51 people who've died. The number of people who said, well, I know dozens of people who are missing, who are not accounted for. And the stench there in the heat suggested there were many more bodies to find, even when we left just a matter of a few days ago. So, yeah, that there are areas where people told us, you know, they went from one place and the roof collapsed, and they ran to the next place and the roof got lifted off, and then they went to a church and then that collapsed and people died. And there was just nowhere to run to. Entire massive areas that have been entirely leveled.
How is food and medical supplies and other relief effort, how are they getting in and getting to the people?
Initially, it was very, very difficult to get aid in. When we first arrived there, there wasn't a lot going on. There is, as it happens, I didn't know this until this year, there's a British ship that stations itself in that part of the Atlantic specifically for this reason. It tracked behind Hurricane Dorian. It's, you know, it is there and staffed with 180 military personnel from May to November, specifically for hurricane season. And they tracked right behind Dorian. And so they moored 10 miles off the coast the day after Dorian left Abaco and went on to Grand Bahama. And so they were managing to get water and ration kits and shelter kits into pockets of the Abaco Islands. But after that, in the days that followed, the emphasis was really on getting people out. So the Bahamian government put on ships, they put on planes to get as many people out. And by the time we left, pretty much everyone who had the means to get out or wanted to get out had got out. But there's a caveat there, which I'll come back to. So in the end, by the time we left, actually the main areas, you know, Marsh Harbour, Treasure Key, had almost got more aid than the people that were left that needed it. But there are other pockets of survivors, communities who are still being found as recently as the weekend. You know, there was a community that hadn't been reached since the hurricane that had just been found again on one of the smaller islands. But the caveat I mentioned there was the shanty town I talked about and the poor people I talked about, a lot of them were undocumented. There's a Haitian community there. And those people, as well as going through this terror of the hurricane coming through, as well as in many cases having lost loved ones and people they cared about, as well as having injuries through flying debris, you know, they all talk about cars flying through the air, doors flying through the air, and, you know, people losing limbs. They were scared of getting help because they were worried about being deported. They were scared of getting off the island and going to Nassau, the Bahamian capital, because they're worried of getting deported back to Haiti. So when I say a lot of people had got off who needed to, there were those who remained because they were scared to do that.
We're talking or looking at the recovery in the Bahamas after Hurricane Dorian, and we're talking with BBC News North America correspondent Ali Makboul, who was in the Abaco area. And if you have family or property there, remember, we would love to hear from you. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Tell us about, again, what you're hearing about those areas. And if you're still looking for donations to send, you can find more information at WLRN.org. Just look up Bahama Strong. Alim, again, the death toll, as we know it, is at 51, expected to rise. But what can you tell us about what officials are tracking, how they're tracking the dead, how they're tracking the missing?
Again, it's difficult for some of the reasons we were talking about, the undocumented community that was affected for a start. And, you know, from the very beginning, people in Marsh Harbor and around Abaco were saying this could well be in the hundreds. And we're talking now about 2,500 that the Bahamian government have said are still missing. A big issue is the fact that communication is still very, very difficult. The communication lines came down during the hurricane. They've been restored to some areas, but it's still very difficult. And with so many people leaving the island, although they have tried at the ports and airports to make sure everyone's enrolled, it's very difficult to track who is where, especially when you didn't know who was there in the first place because of all these undocumented. So they have been focused on, you know, and actually the U.S. Coast Guard, I should say, have been helping with the recovery effort, the search and recovery effort from the very beginning. And they are still involved with that every day. On the last couple of days we were there, we were still seeing bodies being removed by local teams, but also the U.S. Coast Guard. And now the Brits who were there to provide aid are also getting involved in that task as well, because it is seen that there are likely to be many, many more bodies that haven't been recovered as yet. So what the Bahamian government has focused on is getting people to safety. They're staying in, you know, various places around the capital, Nassau, in a gymnasium there where they're being provided aid. But the biggest need for the future is not just for the immediate aid, providing these people with food and water and shelter. It's in, of course, rebuilding. It is finding, you know, everybody was sort of asking us as outsiders, how long do you think it is going to take us to rebuild? And it's such a difficult answer to find when you look around and you don't see anything.
Wait, you had people who from there asking you how long do you think it's going to take to rebuild?
Yeah, I mean, they were saying, you know, have you seen anywhere else, and have you seen how they have managed to recover? And, you know, the thing is, I did cover Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, and when things looked extremely bleak just after the hurricane came through, and to some extent, some things did get back in place relatively quickly because people don't have a choice. They have to find ways to get power and get on with their lives. But I had in the back of my mind that scenario in Puerto Rico, and, you know, people were asking me in the Bahamas, is the help going to come? And you have in the back of your mind what's happened in other disasters, and you know they haven't received what they were promised. And it was difficult conversations. You know, it was difficult to say to them that things would be okay soon. But, of course, they ultimately will be, because, you know, people are resilient, and they have to come back.
I'll finish with this. You have covered other disasters, as you said, hurricanes and earthquakes and such. And I wonder, how does this compare to anything else you've seen?
You know, it is the thing is that I mentioned earlier that will stay with me is the way people seemed utterly haunted by what they had been through, the nightmare they had been through for, you know, 48 hours. It is extraordinary to hear from the National Hurricane Center that for a 20-hour period or so, this hurricane was totally stationary. It went through Abaco very slowly. The National Hurricane Center then said it was traveling at 1 mile an hour. And then they said it was totally stationary. These people did not know when it was going to end. They saw people around them dying. They saw things around them that they could never have imagined. You know, as I say, cars flying through the air. And that is the thing that will stick with me most from this, the sheer terror of what people went through.
We've been talking with BBC News North America correspondent Aleem Maqbool. Aleem, thank you so much for the time. Thank you for sharing.
My pleasure.
And again, if you have family or property there, you can share what you know or what you've heard from the people in the Bahamas. Leave us a message at 786-584-6999. Again, that's 786-584-6999. Well, still to come, have you ever heard of Pelican Island? Do you know why it's so significant to the region? We're going to tell you in a moment, coming up on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. A tiny 3-acre island in Biscayne Bay gets more than 100,000 visitors a year. It's home to a rich diversity of fish and wading birds, with more than 5,400 acres of protected marine life below. Pelican Island holds an important place in U.S. history. In 1903, it became the nation's first designated national wildlife refuge. And just last week, the Bureau of Land Management extended a 40-year agreement for a public land order on the region. It'll allow the organization to protect the area for years to come. Jeremy Edwardson is the deputy project leader for the Everglades Headwaters National Wildlife Refuge Complex, and he joins us now. Jeremy, such a pleasure.
Yeah, pleasure is mine. Thanks for having me.
You know what? Let's start at the beginning real quick, and let's go back to the 1800s. When did people first realize how unique Pelican Island really was?
Sure, yeah. You know, Pelican Island is such a unique area because of all the, for its namesake, really, the pelicans that utilize that small island for nesting. So to kind of fast forward and give you a little bit of a brief history, so it was first recognized as a biologically significant area about the late 1800s, by different scientists due to the high density of nesting brown pelicans and other birds as well. So during that same time, the fashion trends of using bird plumage in the hats was popular enough that actually, feathers are more expensive than gold, and so Pelican Island was a target for those plume hunters that were targeting birds for that. However, due to conservationists such as Frank Chapman and organizations like the Audubon Society, there was also a push to protect those birds at the same time. And one particular individual we like to tout, and is kind of our local hero, is Paul Craigle. Because of the biological significance of the island and his role, and also support with naturalists and ornithologists, President Teddy Roosevelt issued an executive order to set aside Pelican Island as a preserve and breeding ground for native birds on March 14th, 1903.
And I wanted to come back because I don't want to skip over this guy, Craigle. He is fascinating because, again, as you said, there was at the time a very big market for the feathers of these birds. So hunters are poachers and hunters are seeking them out. And then along comes this guy and Craigle, and he is actually like, there have been times literally, well, he'll be on the island with his gun to keep the hunters out.
Yeah, that's the story that we like to tell as well too. So he actually was protecting the island and the birds. Before it was, I guess before he even had the authority to do so as one of our first game wardens in the country. So it's nice for him, for somebody like him to really take a role in that. And, other conservationists and Teddy Roosevelt himself actually recognized that there's somebody in place to step up and protect this island. And, he was able to, because of that, Teddy Roosevelt set aside that land as effectively being the very first federal land set aside specifically for wildlife.
The territory of Pelican Island itself is small, but the surrounding region is also protected, right?
Correct, yeah. So for the sake of the conversation, we can refer to Pelican Island, the small 3-acre island that we have now as Pelican Island proper. So with that, that's the namesake of Pelican Island National Wildlife Refuge. So like what you had mentioned earlier, we actually encompass over 5,400 acres of surrounding that land, which isn't only that island itself, but also waters within the lagoon that is actually leased from the state, and also land that we own and manage as well, too.
I'm talking with Jeremy Edwardson. He is the deputy project leader for the Everglades Headwaters National Wildlife Refuge Complex. That includes Pelican Island. And we're talking about the history of Pelican Island and why it's such an important space here in South Florida. Jeremy, what have been some of the challenges for the Bureau of Land Management to continue to preserve this area? Not just, obviously, Pelican Island, but the area in general.
Yeah, so specifically pointing to the BLM land, that pointing to the public land order that we're referring to, you know, a little bit more of a history on that is that the land that is owned by the federal government was, you know, under their jurisdiction through the BLM was basically withdrew the 37.5 acres of public land for potential from settlement and sale and location, due, you know, under the general laws that was in place at the point. So basically, the withdrawal highlights that it's still protected and is now managed under the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So it extended that withdrawal for another 40 years.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, only 37.5 acres, which doesn't sound like a lot, but really it's the highlight of our refuge with some of the infrastructure that's on that tract of land.
What about that area right now? You think about, for example, some of the things that we're dealing with globally, like, you know, the warming waters and sea level rise. How is that threatening the area? What's the concern there?
Well, yeah, the area that we have, you know, one of the reasons why Pelican Island National Wildlife Refuge is so special, not only because of historical significance, is that it protects, you know, it's a great watershed protection for the Indian River Lagoon up here in Vero Beach. And, you know, with that, not only does it help with sea level rise and erosion of protection, but it also slows down the encroachment of development that we often hear about in South Florida and Central Florida, too.
How do people experience Pelican Island now? I mean, you talk about, like, you know, visitors, because so many people love to go to that area.
Yeah, so Pelican Island proper, you know, the little island itself is actually considered wilderness. It's actually the smallest designated wilderness area in the country as well, too. So with that, there's a few more protections that's in place, and we actually have a buffer around the island itself, a 410-foot buffer. So nobody is allowed within that buffer. However, there's opportunities to view from a distance. You know, specifically, we have some hiking trails on Pelican Island that, like the Centennial Trail, that takes you along a boardwalk. It's an ADA trail that takes you up to a boardwalk and an actual observation tower that overlooks the Indian River Lagoon and Pelican Island itself, too. So you can take those trails and get a self-guided trail of the refuge system and view a variety of wildlife, and then also be able to see the area as well. However, you know, people are often fishing and bird watching in the area too, and so we have quite a bit of land that's actually under our management, or waters, I guess, under our management jurisdiction in the Indian River Lagoon just south of Sebastian Inlet. So that's a really popular spot for fishing and, you know, other opportunities for the public as well.
You know, as someone who worked with the U.S. Department of Fish and Wildlife for many years, I'm wondering for you, what does it mean to manage a place that has such historical significance, ecological significance, you know, to the country? What does it mean for you?
It's definitely special. You know, everybody that even comes with our agency, even comes to visit and walks the boardwalk and overlooks the lagoon and sees Pelican Island itself, it's really special. And for me to be able to say I'm one of the few people that's ever worked for and managed Pelican Island Wildlife Refuge, it's awfully special, particularly being a career Fish and Wildlife Service employee. So it's something that I don't take for granted, and I really appreciate the opportunity too.
And then, you know, just wondering, like, your day-to-day, I mean, you get to be out there. Lots of visitors come, but you get to be there. You get to see it every day. Do you ever get tired of it?
Not that aspect of it at all. It's the reason why we picked this career is to be able to not only, you know, be out in the environment and you know, taking advantage of that opportunity, but also be able to manage it in a way that not only benefits, you know, wildlife and their habitats, but, you know, for the public, for their enjoyment as well.
And, you know, as we mentioned, too, again, that they've extended this agreement for the public land order in the region. So I'm wondering, like, conservation efforts moving ahead into the future, what will those look like?
Well, it's really a chance to capitalize on and brag about the cooperation that we have between our agencies that, you know, although somebody might have, you know, a certain jurisdiction or or label of who owns or manages it. We're working together to protect this area, for the future, to not only protect the watershed and the wildlife habitat, but, also to continue to provide access for recreational activities for American families and other visitors from around the world, too.
Again, Jeremy Edwardson, he is the Deputy Project Leader for the Everglades Headwaters National Wildlife Refuge Complex, and that includes Pelican Island, which we've been talking about. Jeremy, thanks so much for sharing. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I really appreciate the time.
And again, just a little history here. Again, it was 1903. That little island became the nation's first designated National Wildlife Refuge. Really cool little place. Well, that's our program for today, this Tuesday, September 17th. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington and Alejandra Martinez. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepreet. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka. And our technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Now, coming up tomorrow on the program, why are Cubans in Miami being deported back to Cuba? And it's been happening over the past couple of weeks. We'll learn about the recent departure in U.S. Cuban immigration policy under the Trump administration and how that's causing fear among South Florida families. Plus, Manuel Oliver is out with a new show focused on preventing future gun violence. His son, Joaquin Oliver, was killed during the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas. His one-man performance is this Friday at the Colony Theater in Miami Beach. That's all coming up tomorrow on the program. Remember, you can find us online, WLRN.org, on social media, Facebook or Twitter, at WLRN Sundial. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.